That's the Tangong 2 module that was up there, the space station that only had one crew go to it, and that was a two-person crew, and they stayed on there for a little, I think it was exactly 30 days, and then they had come back. So what happened is they needed to prove their version of the Progress ship, by the way, like twice as big as a Russian Progress ship, carries, you know, like 12,000 kilograms instead of, I mean, around 12,000 pounds instead of 6,000 pounds. So they wanted to test to make sure that I was going to be able to dock and be able to refuel, and this is all done autonomously. The crew came back, you know, last year. So just the space station floating around by itself, and they needed to be able to duplicate everything that they originally wanted to do in the 921 program. China had something called the 921 program back in the early 90s, and part of it was developing the space program. And they had a checkoff list of all the things they needed to do to get to where they are. And they've succeeded with that. They first put a man in space, and then two men, and then, you know, three people up in space, brought them back. Then they sent up Tangong 1, the first space station. This is WS2N. And they sent crews up to it. They sent 2-3-person crews to that space station. One of them was a woman. She happened to be a teacher. I guess they tried to duplicate our teacher in space program. Taught all the Chinese kids back on Earth. So when that was over, Tangong 1 is still up there, but they lost the ability to control it. So sometime, I think next year, it's going to come flying out of space and who knows where. They got their fingers crossed, figuring, what, 3/4 of the Earth is all water? Maybe it's going to hit water. So, lost control of that thing. So, since then, they sent up Tangong 2, about the same size as Tangong 1. And they sent one crew up, brought them back, and now they made this other thing, Jinzu, I think. I'll have to look and see how it's pronounced again. But their version of the Progress ship, Sinzu 1, and that worked out well for them, and they were able to move both vehicles, move one away, move the other one away, no problem, all by the thing, dock it autonomously, drop it. So now they'll be ready for their next module. I have the name of that too, but don't know how to pronounce it. That one also starts with the letter T. It's a tango. But that'll be their first module, and they have the names for two other modules, that laboratories that are going to be attached to that. And that will have two docking ports. So you'll have one for a crew to go up, and then another port for cargo to, you know, replenish to the space station. And then when that's gone, you can actually bring two vehicles up if you want, and then you can deorbit the other one. So with two docking collars, they'll be in good shape. So this is why we always have to keep our space program going. I mean, nobody else is going to sit on their hands and not do anything. Back to you, Dick.
I just measured one of the hairs on my arm with my micrometer. One of the average size hairs, and it was almost exactly a thousandth of an inch, which turns out to be 25 micrometers. Yeah, a thousandth of an inch is 25 micrometers. So therefore, 1/10,000th of that. Stand by. Just like I said, it's 2.5 nanometers. So they're aligning those mirrors to the nearest 2.5 nanometers. The wavelength they're using is something like 1,200 nanometers. So they've got something like a 500 to 1, 600 to 1 ratio. way beyond diffraction limited. The average telescope is diffraction limited at a 20th of a wavelength of mirror accuracy. So I'm pretty sure the James Webb barely goes into the visible at the low end, probably 600 nanometers, high end, I should say, high end for its wavelength, for its frequency. And probably the low end is pretty far into the infrared, like maybe 10,000 nanometers. Does that sound a reasonable poll? WS2N, K2IW?
I'm not sure what the, how far it goes in the infrared. I know it's primarily an infrared telescope, but it does visual. I'm trying to remember the numbers. But there were four different golden bands that they were going to cover, and three of them will work at, without the cryogenic units that they have on board, and the fourth one is so far up, it's the infrared, it will not work unless the cryogenic is on. I remember 700 nanometers. I think that was the average. So yeah, I don't know the range yet. We'll find out. So that's going to be an interesting launch. I think there's like 100 or so, I think especially 87 different moves that the telescope has to make to get going. I'm going to call it 100 for the shaft launch and everything else. So all these different things that have to occur. Solar panels have to open up. Antenna has to open up to talk to Earth. Gigantic Mylar panels that are going to open up, a half a dozen of those, spaced what, an inch or so apart, where we reflect the heat from the sun, keep the telescope super cold, plus the telescope itself, the mirrors all have to open up, that tertiary
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I think that's going to, like a swing arm that's going to come off the top of the telescope. It's going to be fastened in three different places. That has to all open up just right. Cryogenics have to work. I don't know what they're thinking. How they ever got this thing approved is beyond me. Back to you, sir.
Because Hubble was so successful eventually, and this is a supersized Hubble at a wavelength that can look through the dust clouds looking at the center of galaxies. It's going to show, if this gives us half of the performance that they're looking for, it's going to be significant. So the deepest infrared measurement, the longest wavelength, the lowest frequency, requires cryogenics. Is that cryogenics, to your knowledge, Paul, a closed cycle refrigeration system? Or is it some kind of a sacrificial gas like a liquid nitrogen that eventually runs out? Okay, Paul, K2IW.
I know it's a helium system. Closed. You don't plan on just, throwing it away. So, minimum lifespan for James Webb is 5 years. They're open for 10 years. And, most of these flights, once they get operating, if they make it to 10, they'll push it to 15 and on and on. Look at Hubble still going. It used to get serviced like on a regular basis. They've had five flights go up since 1990 when it was launched. The last flight was 2009, so here we are 8 years down the road. I remember during that last flight, they said, let's hope for, 7 years. Well, now we're beyond that 7 year point. And they said, latest report, everything's still working on that thing. So they ideally would like to have Hubble and James Webb working at the same time, exactly the same time, looking at the same spots in space for different purposes. I heard that was one of the biggest goals for scientists, astronomers. By the way, Dick, I have calipers and things at my house, but nothing that's going to measure the diameter of my hair. Back to you.
I'm not measuring the diameter, I'm measuring the thickness. An ordinary set of calipers, it's got a sharp point and it's got a two flat sides that come together just below the sharp point. You put a human hair in there and close it, you're measuring the thickness of human hair. And if your hair is anything like mine, you're going to find out it's a thousandth of an inch. Calipers can easily measure the thickness of a human hair, in my opinion, Paul. Could you do it with a micrometer? I think you could, but you'd have to be careful not to crush it as you spin that dial. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Very good. Okay, so you're going to tell me you had some kind of laser interferometry hooked up to it or something. Okay. I didn't realize that. Never did it anything less than probably a 16th of an inch, 32nd of an inch. Very good. Pretty much nothing more to add. I know you asked about the next launch. Like I said before, the best site to go to is spaceflight.com. Actually, spaceflightnow.com. And they tell you everything. The next ones that there's Chinese ones and Russians going up. But the next one would be an Iridium flight out of California on a Falcon 9 rocket. But the next one here would have to be Orbital, ATK. That probably won't be until December on the Antares rocket stick. By the way, have you heard that Orbital, ATK, let me drop it, is being bought up by Northrop Grumman? Have you heard that one? I mean, it's a done deal.
No, I don't think I have. Give me some more words on that.
Northrop Grumman probably is worth like, you know, $50 or $60 billion, and they're going to buy up Orbital ATK, and they're probably in the $8 billion area or something like that. So here's this company. Now Orbital ATK is just the one I'm interested in because they launch Antares rockets from Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia, and like you said, some of those rockets we could actually see the engine exhaust when they go up, and they resupply the International Space Station. They have a Cygnus spacecraft on top of a cargo vehicle that they bring to the space station. So all the ATK part of it is, you know, it's ammunition and things like that. They wound up buying up Orbital, and like 3 or 4 years ago, if you go back and listen to the old tapes, you'll hear me talking about Orbital Science. That was the name of the company that was doing all these rocket launches. Let me drop it. It's amazing how these names, over time, they're really the same companies, but they just change names. Before it was Orbital Science. Before Orbital Science was Orbital Science, it was Morton Thiokyle was the company that built all the solid booster rockets for the shuttle transportation system. All our shuttles that went up, those big boosters on the side, that were all built by Morton Thiokyle. Before Morton Thiokyle, you had Morton Salt, you know, back in the 1930s or whatever it is. So here we are, generations later. So Morton Salt, so Morton Thiokyle in Utah to Orbital Science, and to Orbital ATK in the last couple of years, in 2013 or 2014, they just made that deal. Now that doesn't stop there. Now they're being bought up by Northrop Grumman. Drop it. And of course, Northrop Grumman, they've had all their mergers as well. We had Grumman here on Long Island all these for decades. So that's interesting. Don't know if it's going to be better or worse for space enthusiasts or not, but interesting thing that's happening. Back to you, Jim.
One of the YouTube videos I've seen, which is probably a year or two or three old, Elon Musk was predicting the super boosters he was building. He was going to prove how good they were by sending something in orbit around Mars in the year 2018. At one time, he made that prediction. Boy, is that one optimistic. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, he's getting behind the eight ball a little bit. He's not able to fulfill his dreams. His dream is to have the Falcon 9 go up into orbit, go to the space station with the crew, and have the crew deorbit from the space station in the Dragon spacecraft, the crew Dragon spacecraft, and have it come, start the deorbit, come back on a heat shield, and then after the heat shield, he's going to launch, light these rockets, and these rockets are going to bring them back vertically down to Earth. They're working on, he's got these super Draco rockets, he tested them, everything works fine, but technically it's getting a little hard to do. He's going to put that off. Because of that, that knocked off this 2018 dream of landing that spacecraft on Mars. His goal was to, as of a couple of years ago, to launch a Falcon Heavy from Florida. Falcon Heavy is really three Falcon 9s that are bolted together. It's one core unit, and the other two are acting like boosters. Those two drop off, and they would turn back to Florida. And then the third booster would land on the autonomous drone ship 400 miles out to sea, and that would float back, and they would reuse these things. But the idea of going to Mars is so strong with this guy. That's what drove his whole business from day one. He wanted to, as of a year or two ago, have the Dragon spacecraft on the top of this Falcon 9 Heavy, and send the spacecraft to Mars and come down with propulsion rockets, land vertically on Mars. I heard that's now out the window, maybe in the future, but cross that one off the list. Let me drop it. He still does have plans on sending two people around the moon. Again, that was supposed to be 2018. Let's make that 2 years down the road. I haven't heard anything about that one lately. He does make a lot of predictions. A lot of them, come true. He said he was going to be able to, re-land these booster rockets, 15-story booster rockets on land and out in the sea. He's done that. He's brought back seven of them to land, a total of 16 boosters in all. Landed the rest of them on barges out in the Atlantic Ocean and even the Pacific Ocean, and brought them back safely. He's been able to reuse a couple of them, put them on another flight, and launch them again. So, let me drop it. He's made the prediction for the Falcon Heavy to launch. That was supposed to go originally 2015. He found out that was a little bit more difficult than he thought. Here we are, 2017. That hasn't launched yet, but it's scheduled to go at the end of this year, maybe right December. So his predictions are, they tend to come true, but, kind of like what NASA used to do. NASA used to make a lot of predictions, and a lot of their satellite programs would be delayed. Usually not canceled, just delayed. K2RIW, WS2N.
I believe Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, at the instant they launched off the pad, many of those had an escape rocket on the nose of the manned portion. But in the event of a failure of the booster, you could pull yourself away from the rocket. In Elon Musk's attempt to land human beings back down on the ground vertically, will that manned portion contain that escape rocket, Paul? I hope so, because if you're about to come down with human beings on board tail first, and if that rocket engine should fail, boy, that would get uncomfortable. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how we could do this. I'm trying to make this a short version. All the last systems, the launch abort system, for go through a couple of the rockets for Mercury. They had a tractor type system. Looked like a, you know, an antenna tower. It looked like a Rome tower. Rome tower sitting on top of the spacecraft. And at the top of the tower, they had these three rockets that would, solid booster rockets that would ignite and pull the whole Mercury spacecraft away from the booster in case the booster blew up on the pad or in flight. Gemini, well, they said, well, we don't need this system. We're going to launch without that. And our system for safety will be ejection seat. The door will fly open, and the two astronauts will fly out of the spacecraft, and that's how we're going to save them. My opinion, I think that was a terrible idea, but let me drop it.
I have a question, WA2CEO. Good evening.
How you doing, Andy? And the, okay, and then Saturn V had the tractor system as well. To answer your question, he's doing it, when I say he, Elon Musk with SpaceX is doing it a little different. Right now he's got like 24 little thrusters mounted all over his Dragon cargo vehicle, and that's what you're going to have on the crewed vision version as well. And these are thrusters to, you know, control the attitude, the yaw, pitch, and little rockets. They're called Draco rockets. They don't fail. He's had great success with these things. The big ones that he's going to use for an escape system are called Super Draco rockets, using the same fuel, liquid fuel, and it will be able to, it's inside the craft. It's not going to be a tractor system pulling anything. It's going to be inside. If they need to abort, it will separate from the booster, and either on ground or halfway, in, you know, going all the way up to the altitude. So he's produced about 60,000 pounds of thrust. I'll drop it. Something like 16,000 pounds each. There's a set of eight of them. Actually four units surrounding the spacecraft, and then, you know, two on each unit, so one is always like a backup. So you have eight rockets that will be able to pull the spacecraft away. These are the same eight rockets that he would use as you're coming down and landing on the ground. But like I said, for now, that's been scratched. The Super Dracos will still be on board because you're going to have a crew on board. And in case you have to abort, the Super Dracos will launch and pull the spacecraft away. He successfully has done this. There's a video you can see. The test on the ground, launching from a... from Florida, and it sent the crewed vehicle a couple of miles out to the ocean on parachute. I heard Andy. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Yeah, I got a bunch of questions on this one. Over to you, Andy. W2CDO, K2LIW. You got to get up early tomorrow, Andy. You shouldn't be up this late.
Oh, Dick, you know that I go shopping at this hour. It's 10:30. And I just... I just picked up what I needed to pick up, and I'm heading home. And if you guys didn't know, I'm pretty sure you do know that what's been going on in Puerto Rico has myself, involved in handling emergency traffic communications. But as you know, since the hurricane, there was little or no communications at all, along with power and everything else. So they have these net frequencies set up and are operating sporadically, though. At least right now, until all the generators that the military is deploying down there to get some power back on the island. Anyway, I don't want to distract you from your conversation because this is a whole different subject. So let me just let it drop because I have a question in regards to rockets.
As I see it, they brought a bunch of generators down there, but I don't think they brought anywhere near enough fuel. On the news reports, I see people standing on very long lines trying to get gasoline to run those generators. Over to you, Andy.
Reports are coming in sporadically on the HF bands. If you listen, some stations are shutting down pretty early because they don't want to use up all their fuel, whatever fuel they have. And you know that this is going to be happening. It's going to last for days, maybe months, because of all the work that they have to do. But anyway, I'm sorry I just distracted you from the space report, but I want to touch the space report a second. Dick, can I do that?
If you pay me enough. Go ahead, Andy.
It's actually a question to both you guys, something that we don't normally talk about, but as you know, we've had these natural disasters, the earthquake in Mexico and the hurricanes and so on, but what about the threat of North Korea? And the reason why I'm bringing that up is we keep seeing North Korea launching these rockets as sort of flexing their muscles and showing us what they can do. And, of course, the talk was also to deploy a hydrogen bomb on a rocket ship and, of course, launch it to us, the United States. So my question is, in regard to that, what is our missile defense system consist of, if you can bring it up a little bit? In other words, how are we going to defend ourselves if this occurs? Because it seems like the threat is getting, as we hear these reports, the threat is getting more serious day by day. So, not to get into all the politics, but it does touch the topic of space or rockets, because it is a rocket that's going to be launched, unfortunately, against us. What's your opinion on all this? Dick, I'll give it to you first.
There have been a number of weapon systems developed which are supposed to shoot down a rocket. Depending on which report you read, they're somewhat successful or not so successful. And so, have these been deployed in South Korea, Hawaii? There are reports now that Hawaii is instructing its residents as to how to protect themselves from a nuclear event. They think it's possible. So, if he does a launch, and if it's hostile, and you've got to stop it, my gut feel is that there's a 50-50 chance we can stop it. In which case, what's our next response going to be? I got some guesses on that one. Let's see what Paul's got to say. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, Andy, very good on the HF work with Puerto Rico. I think that's a major topic. Much more important than what we're talking about here. I don't even know about the generators that were coming off the ship. That's good to know. It's half the problem. The other half is now getting fuel. But as far as the rockets go, he's been able to launch these things as far as, going over the island of Japan, which is kind of unnerving. This is, they're not the best rockets in the world. You wouldn't want that thing to either, come down and hit Japan. I'm sure it doesn't have a bomb on it right now, but it could do a lot of damage if it hit a populated area. So that's kind of weird that they're allowing that at all. And then the other ones that he has are shorter range missiles. So, they could go down to the South Korea. That's not good. The question is whether or not he can put one of his nukes on top of one of these things, send it into space, and then have a heat shield to be able to bring it back through the atmosphere. That's what I understand. He's not that far yet, along. So, he's never launched anything into orbit yet. They've actually launched their own spacecraft, a couple of flights. So they have that capability to go all the way around the world. This guy, I guess, can't be too far behind.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WB2BXO.
Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, very good. Wanted to be acknowledged before, by net control before I went ahead. My question on this is, first of all, I did think North Korea did launch to orbit at one point, though it's questionable just what they launched a couple of years ago. Maybe I'm mistaken. I haven't Googled it yet to check my facts. Second of all, my big question on this is, where is North Korea getting their expertise? To my knowledge, they have no great university physics and engineering department there that's building this stuff with their own talent. Are they buying the talent from the Japanese or the Russians? If they have their own talent, is when that regime finally collapses, is whoever gets custody of all that talent going to win the next century, just as we used Germany's rocket talent to launch the moon program? What are your thoughts on that? Where are they getting the talent to do this? I mean, this may be very old technology by our standards, but they're still making very rapid progress, and the expertise is coming from somewhere. Go ahead.
That was South Korea launched orbital rockets.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I don't think North has launched some pretty long range recently, but I don't think anything to orbit. And if he wants to reach the United States from North Korea, I think he's got a close to coming into orbit. And it might be also true for getting to Hawaii. Hawaii is closer to him than the northwest corner of the United States, I believe. I have to look at our globe to confirm that. He certainly is, he's rattling the sabers an awful lot, and seems to be demanding a whole lot of respect, but he doesn't seem to be able to sit down and negotiate. It doesn't sound like he wants to talk to anybody. And I'd like to believe he's got enough brains to know that if he really did launch a weapon to one of these places, you have to know there's going to be some retaliation. Anybody got any further comments? Give me a call at us, K2LAW.
Just wanted to make one comment on that, because then I have to go back on the road. Let me let it drop a second, make sure I'm not doubling. If he does deploy a nuclear rocket towards the United States or towards some other country right now, right this second, the question I have is, do we have the capabilities of shooting it down? There was that mentioned a number of weeks ago that we can deploy a rocket that would do that. Is that really true? Do we have the capability right now at this time? That's just one burning question that I have. I'll give it back to you, Dick.
They had a couple of tests that were successful tests.
Yeah, give us some words on that, Paul.
I believe the target vehicle was launched from Kwajalein Island, not the Marshall Islands, the Pacific. And then they launched another one from, I don't know if it was, I don't think it was from Vandenberg or Air Force Base. It might have been, or it might have been from another island. I'm not sure. It might even be top secret. So, but yeah, they have done that a couple of times. You know, this thing coming from Kwajalein is duplicating an attack. But then, a year or two ago, they had a couple of misses. So, I don't know, I think they're about 50-50. What you said originally, Dick. So the thought is, you know, if they get, let's say, four missiles off, rockets off, and we take out two, that means two more are coming through. Back to you, Dick.
With his lack of financial resources and the rate at which he can obtain the raw materials to build these things, got to be refining uranium or plutonium as the fuel for these nuclear devices. I don't think he has the resources to launch four at once. And the launches that he's been doing, I think there's a month of separation in between each one of these launches, which allows him to build the next one, so to speak. So, is he really going to do it? Is he that crazy? That's a tough one. Anybody want to pick it up? Go right ahead. K2RIW.
WS2N.
You got it, Paul.
I'm always more worried about getting attacked within. You know, if you could put a nuke on a rocket, maybe you could put one in a suitcase. So, you know, I'm sure not that small, but that type of thing. You know, one of these characters coming across that we don't know about, that's what you have to worry about. You know, we'll be waiting for rockets to come across the horizon and, you know, they'll be sneaking in the back door.
I'm a little more doubtful of that one, Paul. That's very high technology. Not necessarily very big yield, but that's very high. He did say he was going to launch a bomb on a missile and explode it at high altitude. And he may not know that the United States did some experiments on that, I guess in the early 80s or the late 70s. And when you blast a bomb in the atmosphere, you get a huge shock wave because of the air being heated. In space where there's no air, you get a huge amount of particles, charged and uncharged particles, most of them charged, moving at close to the speed of light. And 1,000 miles away, they can knock out an electrical power system. When they did some air testing, they had a lot of failures of the power system in Alaska and Hawaii. So if he does that, even though he thinks he's just testing his nuke in space and not targeting any particular chunk of land, he could create an awful lot of mischief by the electromagnetic pulse he'll be creating. KQLIW listening.
I just got to sign out because I'm here, but I just want to make one final comment on this. I know I distracted you you guys from the discussion that you had with friendly space exploration. Fortunately, we're dealing with not so friendly stuff, as you know. Anyway, I just hope it doesn't come to something where he's going to launch, because he's continued to do that. Like I say, he's continuing to, you know, just to show us his power. And we just incorporated, and that's not the right word, I'm trying to think of the word. We just put more sanctions on them, as you probably heard in the news. And the prime, secretary, you know, their prime minister or whoever, you know, at the UN, when Trump made his speech at the UN, I forgot his name, but, you know, he came back and he said, North Korea came back and they said that we're going to regret what Trump said. Anyway, I just hope it doesn't come to that. But it seems like more and more we're heading in the wrong direction with North Korea, and I'm just hoping that it doesn't come to something like that as the final thing. All right. Then I got to sign out. Go ahead, Jake. I'll get back to you.
Andy, if your name was Donald Trump, tell me what you think you would do.
I wouldn't hesitate. I would just I want to say the word, but I wouldn't hesitate. I would just go after it right now and get rid of it. Why let it linger?
You'd have to do that awful carefully, because without being super careful, you're going to kill an awful lot of civilians. Maybe Frank's got a solution. Go right ahead, Frank. KQLIW.
Colin. Well, there was a very good comment online a week or two ago by a former Navy SEAL who suggested dropping millions of iPhones over North Korea and orbiting a satellite to provide free service to them. And apparently some experts think there's actually some merit to that idea. I understand it's been tried on a small scale, something, anyway, providing Wi-Fi service to dissidents, etc., has been tried on a small scale in the Middle East. Never on that scale. Anyway, that's the only kind of viable, potentially peaceful solution I've heard of. I did look on space.com, by the way, does have an article saying that the North Koreans are believed to have orbited a satellite a couple of years ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's hard to believe. The person who said comment, who was that?
C1SAM. It's really a question for Paul.
You've got it, Sam.
Yeah, Paul, if he was to detonate an H-bomb in space or up in high altitude, is the ISS protected from the pulse?
Yeah, well, they're 250 miles up, so they're okay. They're not going to, you know, the chances of him detonating the thing, you know, when the ISS is going along that same inclination, you know, is probably, you know, one in 90. And then he'd have to, the ISS would have to be on that particular side of the Earth when that all happened. We'd have to choose 250 miles up to light this thing off. Now, could you have EMP affect the station? You know, it affected satellites. I know what Dick was talking about when they tested in space. It affected some of our satellites. So, you know, you might have a problem with a pulse getting into a space station, I guess, if it was near it or under it. You don't know how high this guy would put his satellite. My guess is he'd be happy to get above the common line, which is, 62 kilometers, 100 miles up. Back to you, Dick.
EMP is what I was talking about.
Yeah, the EMP. I it could be, you know, it might be a problem. I don't know.
I believe the EMP falls off by inverse square law. So if there's a good number of miles between the space station and that blast, it might not be serious. But would he be crazy enough to launch at such a time when the space station is nearby? That would be awfully nasty. As I see it, that is essentially an act of war, just like sending a weapon to explode over a friendly territory. In either case, he would be declaring a state of war. I'd like to believe he's not that crazy. K2RIW.
Well, quick opinion, KC1SAM. If he's crazy enough to do it, he's going to be crazy enough to do it at the worst possible time. That's why I see the ISS and EMP travels for a great distance. It's pretty potent. Anyway, just curious. That's about it.
Yeah, I think that EMP can be fairly serious at 1 or 2,000 miles. You get a tremendous number of high power, high velocity particles coming out of that weapon when there's no air nearby to attenuate and absorb them and to absorb the shockwave. There is no shockwave. It's all pure nuclear energy. And when those Compton electrons strike a conductor, get X number of volts per meter across that conductor, so every piece of wire picks up a whole lot of voltage, and protecting from that is not easy. So I can see what Andy's worried about, and maybe we should be worried too. But what can we do? It's in the hands of Mr. Trump and the Secretary of Defense, and they probably have a lot of plans. And they're claiming that they're not announcing what their plans are. We can make some guesses as to what those plans are. As I see it, the bare minimum retaliation would be a whole lot of drones aimed at very specific targets to remove his ability to launch these things. T2RIW.
Yeah, I think the plan is not to look like the bad guy by doing anything first. You have to let him do something first, unfortunately, and then less people will be pissed off at us or retaliating.
Now, are we able to tell whether a missile being launched has a live warhead on it or not? In other words, do we have the ability to launch against him on warning, or would we have to wait to see if the missile, whether a live warhead actually exploded in space or somewhere else before we launched against him?
because of the amount of flame out of the back of the rocket and the trajectory it takes, is my belief that you can make a guess as to what is the mass of the payload, whether or not it's empty or it's really got some X number of pounds of stuff on board in the warhead. If he is doing a certain kind of testing where he wants it to be safe, but he wants to test it under live, under working conditions, and puts a whole bunch of sand in the warhead to substitute for the weight of a real weapon, could that create a false alarm that makes us think that that's a loaded weapon? Something to worry about, K2RIW.
I think if it's coming over the horizon, they're going to shoot it down. What is it, the Aegis system, or I think it's the name of the system that they have. They're going to shoot that thing out of the sky. They won't care if it's got sand or a nuke on it, you know, one way or the other. And they're worried about shooting it off to Guam first, because that was, you know, relatively close to him. So if anything goes near Guam, I've already heard on the news that they want to shoot it out of the sky. And by the way, all these nukes he keeps launching in the mountain, they're worried about this mountain actually starting to collapse, that it might cause earthquakes. Sure enough, a couple of days later, they had an earthquake in Japan. Back to you, Dick.
To your knowledge, Paul, has anyone claimed that the earthquake in Japan was caused by what's going on in North Korea, which is, what, 1,000 miles away?
No, but it makes me wonder, you know, I mean, a couple of times with all these disasters lately, they said it could cause an earthquake with these explosions, especially the last one with a hydrogen bomb. And then, what, a day or two later, Japan had the earthquake. Nobody said it, so that's only my guess. It was ironic. But then they said this hurricane, Hurricane Harvey, so powerful, they were reading it on the seismometers in California, wherever they have the seismometers. So they got a reading on that, but sure enough, they had an earthquake in Mexico. And then they had one relatively small earthquake, and then just recently another hurricane came by, and then they had that big earthquake in Mexico. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the date of the most recent hurricane, the second of the most recent, the 7.1 Richter, was exactly the same date of the month as the 1985 Mexico City earthquake. I had just gotten my satellite receiving system, my TVRO, a month or two before the earthquake of Mexico City, 1985. And boy, did I see a whole lot of raw news reports of the attempt to remove all those people from the buildings. I forget the number of fatalities of that one, but it was an awful big number. And they've probably strengthened their buildings somewhat since then. This time the number of fatalities is smaller, but still pretty significant. Do you have any pleasant subjects about spacecraft that we should be discussing, Paul? We've had enough unpleasant subjects in the last half hour. WS2N, K2IW.
It's Roy Roy. I have a non-political question for you.
You got it, Joe.
Stick to a manned space program and robotic space program. How you doing, Joe? Back to you, Dick.
You got it, Joe.
It's actually two questions aimed right for you, Dick. Do you have a rotor on your television antenna? That's question number one. And number two, were you near a radio on Monday night?
No radio, no rotator on my television aerial so far. I've been talking about doing that for some time. But what radio program should I have aimed at if I had the ability, Paul? I mean, Joe, go ahead.
Well, Dimitri, I called you on the radio because I wasn't sure if you had a rotator on your TV antenna or not. Apparently you don't, so it would have been a moot point anyway, but... no, I got a rare station, a TV station on Monday evening, about 9 o'clock, about 9:45. I've been waiting to get this one for a long time. And you can ask your broadcast engineer, because I'm sure he's listening in the background, where WPTZ is. I know where it is. Ask him.
Eric may not be on board right now. KE2EJ, K2IW, do you know where WTTT is located?
K2IW, K2EJ. Was that WKTU or WKTT?
WTTZ, Papa Tango Zulu. Whiskey Papa Tango Zulu. Look that up in your list.
Give me a minute. Roughly how many miles was that one, Joe?
Probably close to 400, I think.
Would you call that an extended ground wave propagation? Got a guess as to what kind of propagation was getting that signal to you?
Don't really know. Don't really know. It was on RF channel 14, and I believe that transmitter's on Stowe Mountain, or something near Stowe, Vermont. It's on like a 4,000-foot mountain. They're putting out a decent amount of ERP from that location also. I've seen them down here with a spectrum analyzer, and I could tell that, it's their carrier that's there, but I've never had it come in strong enough where I could decode the picture. And this one was a whopper. When the band opened up in that direction, I was getting their carrier, and I look at that spike, at about minus 55 feeding my television decoder. It was quite viewable for quite a while.
Yeah, phonetically again for me.
Whiskey Papa Tango Zulu.
All right, Joe, I think you're saying you believe that that was Stowe, Vermont, Stowe Mountain. I forget what it's called. I've skied that mountain a few times. I forget what the mountain is called.
In Plattsburgh, at least that's where the studio is. Let me find out where the transmitter is.
Is that Plattsburgh, New York?
Yeah, on the Canadian border.
Roger.
It's even with Plattsburgh. And I also got another one on RF32, a public a PBS station. I think that was WETK. And the funny thing is, there was three other transmitters up there off of the same towers, and I couldn't get them. Not really sure why.
Another minute to get the information up.
Question for Joe.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Paul, WSLN. Do a lot of the over-the-air TV. I have that set up as well, although I have cable. But when I watch it, if it's a rainy day, I will get channel 8. Now, I don't have a rotator on mine either, but mine's facing New York City, and I get most of the stations in that direction. But then, if it rains, 100% of the time, if it rains, I will lose, I'll start to lose channel 7 ABC City, and sure enough, I'll pick up all the channel 8, 8.1, 8.2, 8.3, that's, from Connecticut. Isn't that odd? I wonder if you ever noticed anything like that.
Oh, that's an easy one. That's WTNH. That's in New Haven. They're on, I think, what they call Matmir Mountain, which is a mountain range just inland from the coast. A ways, maybe about 20 miles inland, and it's a fairly high ridge. That's where the transmitter is located on. They're DT8. They are actually RF Channel 10 from New Haven. It's an ABC affiliate.
Okay, yeah, but when it rains, I noticed they're ABC stations. When it rains, I get that station. When it doesn't rain, it's back to the city. And no more Channel 8.
I got you some information.
Go right ahead, Eric.
The transmitter is located 44 degrees, 31 minutes, 32 seconds north latitude. 72 degrees, 48 minutes, and 58 seconds west longitude. The effective rated power of the ERP is 650 kilowatts. Not a heck of a lot. Average height above terrain is 845 meters. It's 1,270 meters above mean sea level. And the antenna height above ground is 46 meters. Now let me find out exactly where 44 by 72 is.
Mount Mansfield, Phil.
Did you say Mount Mansfield?
These are the place in Phil. I believe the transmits out of, that's the Big Ski Mountain, right across the street, Green Creek. There's two right there, KC1SAM.
The transmitter's on the top of a mountain around, just on the, it looks like it's just on the Vermont side of the border, and it's in a place called North Pole.
How's that for DX, Dick? Not bad, huh?
So you've talked to the North Pole. Did you give them your Christmas list?
Oh, that's where the transmitter's supposed to be. This is North Pole. I keep my Christmas list. I don't know.
Well, you weren't transmitting. You were listening. So there's no easy way for you to give them your Christmas list. Making a list and checking it twice. So, now, since there's a way you can get the Latin long, and there's various programs you can go to, you can find out the exact bearing and distance if you really cared. And it sounds to me like it's really down the road a piece. This time of year, we sometimes get some pretty nice openings to New England, for instance. Were you getting this opening like 10 o'clock at night, Joe? Over to you, Joe, K2LIW.
You were getting it as virtual channel 5?
Yes, DT515253. Yes, I got it at 9 o'clock at night to about 9:45. And then after that, it petered out and went away.
Well, next time you see an opening like that, tune into the Pittsburgh and the Philadelphia stations. They seem to come through a lot. There's a Channel 12 and a Channel 10 that come from that direction.
You've got a television receiving aerial, I believe, on the tower in Plainview. And I think it has a rotator on it. So, what kind of television DX have you seen over the years, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLIW?
Yeah, make sure you say something. At the same time, I've already gotten this channel before. I got RF 12 from Albany, which is actually west of Albany. They were coming at the same time.
Yeah, well, you were probably looking north, Phil. You get more stuff if you look east. But then again, it all depends upon how the propagation is in that particular direction. But I'm looking at their great big coverage map, and it's pretty big. I mean, they're on top of a mountain that's, I gave you the height. The place is called, what you call it? It's called, the name of the mountain is called the Nose, N-O-S-E.
And what state is that in, Eric?
Actually, it's on the New York side of the line, but it's in a place called North Pole, New York.
Now, that's funny. I looked at the FCC website, Eric, and that says the same thing. It says they're on North Pole in New York, but if you look at the coordinates they give you, they match other coordinates for WCAX, which is RF-22 from the same location in Vermont. So how do you explain that one?
What was the station that you said was the same? Because we've got, what is it, WCAX in the same... on the same tower.
Well, they list the studios, like, I guess the studios type Burlington, Vermont. But one of the FCC websites I use shows that to be off of this mountain in Vermont, not New York.
Eric, to your knowledge, what is the longest distance you've ever become aware of between the studio and the transmitter? How long a distance are they sometimes separated?
Well, some places the studio is in the same building as the tower, like right here. But take my friend Steve, who runs a station in Hawaii. Actually, his studio is in Honolulu. It's right on the university property. The transmitter is on top of the mountain. And maybe about 30 miles line of sight. But actually, the studio connects to Syracuse, New York, and Syracuse, New York sends the stuff to the transmitter, so it's not like they're going from studio to transmitter. It's a pretty long path.
Boy, it sounds like Syracuse is Syracuse one of the main